Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. How do you discipline a teenager who started an enormous wildfire? Well, a judge says the appropriate penalty is $36 million. We'll tell you the story in a few minutes. Our first set of stories today comes from Olympia. A Republican state senator wants to cut off Seattle's head tax. Two local billionaires write million-dollar checks for a state gun control initiative. And the governor, Jay Inslee, continues to not run for president. Here to catch you up on those stories, KUOW's Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins. Hello.
Hello, Bill. Great to be here.
We begin with Seattle's new head tax, $275 per employee on companies grossing $20 million a year. The Republican Senate Minority Leader, Mark Schessler, says he wants to rub out that tax. What is his argument?
Well, he says it's not legal, and he says that this is unconstitutional, that the local governments have to derive the permission to raise taxes from the legislature. And so he's saying you can't do this. Now, he's not suing to overturn it. What he's doing is saying he's got a bill ready to introduce in 2019 that would very specifically say a city or a town may not impose a tax measured by employee wages or employee hours or the number of employment positions. But keep in mind that all of the things you just mentioned that we're going to talk about suggests that there's something going on here. Maybe it's a political year, an election year. It's heating up, and there's a lot of politics going on around this head tax, as well as serious concerns on both sides.
Yes, and how much political support does the minority leader have on this?
He's been kind of a lonely voice in this in terms of the state legislature. There is a Democrat, Senator Mark Mullett from Issaquah, who's a small business owner, who's been somewhat outspoken as well, saying he's concerned about this and that the legislature could act next year on this. But this has really been something that Senator Schessler, the minority leader of the Republican caucus, previously the majority leader, the senator from Ritzville. I mean, you can't really get to a place in Washington that is more different and apart from Seattle. He's sort of trying to be the voice from outside Seattle.
Yes, he is. Senator Schessler has been running against Seattle in many ways. Does Seattle passing a head tax move any lawmakers in his direction?
I'm not sure it moves lawmakers in his direction, but it's thematic. I mean, last year, if you'll remember, he moved the Cascade Divide west and turned it into the Emerald City Curtain. Actually, I think that happened early this year, at the beginning before the session started. But last year, there was a special election for the state senate in the 45th district on Seattle's east side, the Redmond area. That was the race to determine majority control of the state senate. And that was very much a race where Republicans ran against liberal Seattle. And it didn't work. The Democrat in that race won. But it appears that Senator Schessler is sort of going for broke on the idea that as Seattle goes, maybe not the rest of the state goes, but it's a threat to the rest of the state. And he really wants to show that Seattle politics, Seattle policies, and Seattle liberalism is in his view, a threat to the rest of the state, to the economy, and just a great comparison and contrast point.
Okay, well, whether the head tax goes down in Olympia or not, there is a campaign by Seattle businesses to repeal it. Tacoma, meanwhile, seems to like the tax. The city's made a YouTube video with all caps subtitles saying, "No head tax here. You'll like Tacoma. You'll like the South Sound. We welcome jobs." Okay, that's the latest on the head tax, and we're talking with KUOW Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins. Austin, the Alliance for Gun Responsibility announced yesterday it has raised $3 million for a fall ballot initiative, and this initiative would do what?
This initiative would do a number of things. It has to do with primarily regulating semi-automatic rifles, also known in some quarters as assault weapons. It would raise the minimum age for purchase of these weapons to 21. It would require an enhanced background check, which is really the background check that today is required for pistols versus long guns, and that involves a local law enforcement check as well as the instant federal NICS check. There's also a provision in this initiative having to do with responsibility for safely storing your gun, and if you don't do that, and a child gets shot and injured or killed, for instance, that you could be held criminally liable for not safely storing your gun. There's also a 10-day waiting period for the purchase of a so-called assault weapon as a part of this. So a lot of provisions, all having to do with what the sponsors say are gun safety and gun responsibility, but certainly viewed by gun rights advocates as further restrictions on access to guns.
The big donors for this initiative, Austin, are Seahawks owner Paul Allen and venture capitalist Nick Hanauer. They've each donated $1 million apiece. Is this a grassroots effort, or is this just two giant sequoias?
Maybe two giant sequoias who are going to help seed the rest of the smaller donors to contribute to this. You know, this is a topic and an issue where there's no trouble getting money for these campaigns. There's a lot of grassroots support out there, and there's a lot of wealthy Washingtonians, even people from outside the state. Michael Bloomberg comes to mind, who are willing to fund and write big checks. Keep in mind, it costs several $1 million to get on the ballot. They're in a compressed time schedule right now. They are not out with their petitions yet. So they're going to have a very short amount of time to get this qualified by July. You have to get over 260 or about 260,000 signatures. And then, of course, you need money to run a campaign. And so this is a finely tuned machine because they've got these. This is a poll tested issue. They, you know, note what's not in here. They're not, for instance, limiting magazine capacity. That should tell us something, that they pulled on that and that doesn't work among voters. They need to start out with something that gets 60% or better support going into this campaign. They know they've got the financial backing, get it on the ballot, and then run a very robust, expensive campaign to try to get it passed in the fall.
And Washington voters have passed gun control measures before. What do you think the odds are of this initiative, 1639?
They've passed gun control measures in the past. Background checks comes to mind. They've done it with big donations from Paul Allen and Nick Hanauer and others in the past. Again, we've seen this play before, and the chances are good because, again, they are so finely tuning these measures to appeal to a plurality of voters here to pass. And so really what is noteworthy is what's not in here. It's not a ban on assault weapons. It's raising the age limit. It's not a limit on the size of the magazine capacity. It's an enhanced background check. Finely tuned, likely to pass.
Finally, on that subject, it could only pass if it makes it on the ballot, and I understand the NRA is mounting a legal challenge?
That's right. So the ballot title language, what you, the voters, see on your ballot, is often the subject of a very heated behind-the-scenes legal fight. If the opponents or the proponents don't like what the Attorney General comes up with, they can go to court. That's what's happening right now. So there is a legal fight prompted by the NRA that has to do with the language that will appear on the ballot, and they can't go out to start collecting signatures until that's resolved. And what that means is they're likely to miss Memorial Day weekend, which is a really key weekend for signature gathering.
Talking with KUOW Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins. One more note for you, Austin. Our Governor Jay Inslee continues to not run for president in 2020. Yes, he is challenging the president about a plan to arm teachers, challenging him on national television. Yes, he's a guest on Bill Maher's HBO show. Yes, we just learned he's giving a speech in Iowa next month, but he's not running for president. And I know that because he told me himself last time he was here. Take a listen.
Are you running for president?
I've got the best job in the world right now, and I'm doing it, and it is. I mean, our state is
not a denial.
I'm running for, I'm a governor. I intend to be governor.
Not a denial. He is a governor and intends to be a governor. Why would people think he's dodging that question? He is not running for president. So, Austin, what is he doing in Iowa?
Well, what he's doing technically is giving a speech to the Democratic Party of Iowa. It is a state where there is a hotly contested governor's race. The spokeswoman for the Democratic Party there said it was a no-brainer to invite Inslee because of his role as the chair of the Democratic Governors Association. But it is rather convenient, and we are watching to see where he goes, and then Iowa pops up, and you just can't help but say, well, isn't that where all future presidential contenders find a reason to go to? He did get the invitation, though. He does have a role to play as the DGA chair, and there is a big governor's race going on. But certainly, it's easy to read into this. And if he keeps up with this kind of stuff, the rumors that he's running are only going to continue. He's feeding this.
Yes. I wonder what would be the next completely predictable thing that all politicians testing presidential waters do that will surprise us when our governor, who's definitely not running for president, does that thing.
So I know you've got one and I've got one. What's yours?
Book deal.
Okay, trip to New Hampshire.
We're watching you, New Hampshire. Okay, there you go. Neither adding nor subtracting fuel to the speculation about a Jay Inslee presidential run. That is KUOW's professional Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins, with a carbon-neutral analysis for you. Austin, always great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Likewise. You're welcome.
More of KUOW's The Record just ahead. It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. A judge in Oregon has ruled that the person who started last year's giant Eagle Creek fire will have to pay $36 million in damages. That's $36 million that a 15-year-old Vancouver boy will have to pay. How did this teenager find himself in this situation? Oregon Public Radio reporter Amelia Templeton has the answer. She joins us now. Hi, Amelia.
Hello.
How did this boy start an enormous wildfire?
He was hiking on the popular Eagle Creek Trail with a group of young friends and chucked a smoke bomb into the woods. It was a dry day, windy day, and that ignited a massive wildfire in the gorge. And the district attorney eventually established that he had acted recklessly, but couldn't show that he'd meant to start a fire. He pleaded guilty to 12 charges, including reckless burning, and has been sentenced to probation and almost 2,000 hours of community service.
Wow. So $36 million is what you get when you plead guilty. Will you remind us the impact, Amelia, of the Eagle Creek fire?
Yeah. So right from the outset, it was an unusual fire. The day that it started, it trapped about 140 hikers, adults, kids, a dog, on the Eagle Creek Trail, and they were stuck overnight, essentially fleeing the fire, hiking away from it. There was a massive evacuation effort. And then the fire came very close to burning down the town of Cascade Locks. Hundreds of people and their livestock and pets evacuated. It ended up burning for 3 months, mostly on federal forest land, jumped across the Columbia River and started burning on the Washington side of the gorge as well. And parts of the historic Columbia River Highway on the Oregon side of the gorge are still closed, and many of the most popular hiking trails in the gorge remain closed.
You were out there reporting this in the forest, weren't you, Amelia?
I was, yes. I spent some time with ranchers evacuating horses. I spent some time with those hikers who, you know, described this very tense night that they spent in the woods having to put out little spot fires with their water bottles.
Okay, so let's get to that dollar amount. Making a teenager pay $36 million, why
yeah.
such a high amount in this case?
So the dollar amount is based on two things. The first is claims that 11 different parties submitted for costs or damages related to the fire. And then Oregon's juvenile statute, which is kind of unusual, and it requires what it calls juvenile delinquents to repay in full victims of their crimes for monetary damages. So the judge in this case, there was a restitution hearing. The judge is supposed to evaluate whether or not the claims submitted are factual. But the way the law is written, the judge doesn't have discretion to lower the restitution amount. And the teen's defense attorney really challenged the law, said that, you know, this $36 million fine amounts to cruel and unusual punishment for this teen who comes from, a family without a lot of money. But ultimately, the judge disagreed and found that the law was appropriate and that the fine was proportionate to the harm that the teen caused.
Well, does the judge lay out a plan for how this teenager would pay $36 million in fines?
So we don't know how that's going to work yet. The juvenile department in Hood River County can develop a payment plan, you know, essentially monthly installments. They've been directed to do that. And, you know, we've asked what that's going to look like, and they haven't shared that information yet. And there's another sort of important safety valve in the law, which is that after 10 years, if this young man completes all of his probation, his community service, keeps up with his payments, they can revisit this in court again at the end of 10 years and potentially reduce the balance or even forgive what remains at that point.
Boy, monthly installments, that sounds so easy when it's a car, but I think monthly installments on a $36 million bill still sounds gigantic. And if I'm a teenager, it sounds like a life sentence. Who gets the money, whatever he is able to pay?
This is one of the things I find extraordinary about this case. It's not mostly homeowners or private individuals. It's mostly state and federal agencies. So the U.S. Forest Service submitted a claim for $21 million, which is essentially the cost of fighting the fire and the ongoing cost of all of the trail work and bridge repairs that need to take place. The Oregon Department of Transportation has submitted a claim for $12.5 million. You know, the Union Pacific Railroad and Allstate Insurance all have claims. There's really only three sort of smaller private groups that are involved in this. There's one house that burned in the town of Warrendale, and the renter there and the homeowner there have both submitted claims. And then a trail group that lost a couple of lodges has also asked for restitution. But really, it's a lot of big federal and state institutions that are making these claims against this teenager.
This is amazing to me, Amelia. So this is mostly a public debt. So, son, the main reason you owe $36 million is that it's really needed by the U.S. Treasury. Is there any plan to appeal this fine, Amelia?
We've asked the teen's attorney directly, and he hasn't answered the question. But I think the fact that he argued that Oregon's juvenile restitution statute violates both the state constitution and the U.S. Constitution, the prohibitions on cruel and unusual punishment. And that seemed to be potentially laying the groundwork for an appeal.
What a story. Amelia Templeton was there in the forest reporting it, and she's at Oregon Public Broadcasting and is telling you the latest developments, the judge's finding that those $36 million in claims, those are legitimate claims. We'll see what happens next. Amelia, thanks.
You're very welcome.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back. It's rush hour. I-5 is a parking lot, except for a few drivers who try to get ahead by repeatedly changing lanes. You know who you are. KUOW reporter David Hyde spoke with a KUOW listener, Mariah St. Clair, who wants to know,
is traffic weaving worth it? UW traffic expert Mark Hallenbach says he can't answer that question because no traffic engineer has studied it. What he can say,
weaving is disruptive. Disruption reduces efficiency. Reductions in efficiency cause congestion. So we don't like weaving.
But Hallenbach admits that sometimes you might get there a little faster by weaving, especially if you're willing to be a jerk. So let's find out. I'm in my car about to get on I-5 headed south into heavy Seattle traffic. In another car is our question asker, Mariah St. Clair. She's headed to work downtown, about 6 miles away. And for this unscientific experiment, Mariah's gonna pick a lane and stick with it, and I'm gonna change lanes a bit, and we'll see who gets there faster.
It's pretty backed up, as usual.
I'm a car behind Mariah, so she's got a head start.
I like to stay in this lane so that mostly I just can keep going. So it's kind of slow and steady wins the race is my plan.
Okay, I'm weaving. Okay, I'm weaving again. There's a man in a blue Prius behind me right now, and he's shaking his head and making a weaving symbol with his hand, like his hand is like a fish swimming through the water, and he's shaking his head like, you idiot, stop weaving.
The thing is, he was right. At that point, after weaving in and out of traffic, I was way behind Mariah. So why did it seem like I would get there way ahead of her by changing lanes? Dr. Donald Redelmeyer has studied that. And his answer takes us back to our original question, is traffic weaving worth it?
Under congested roadways, our own eyes start to play tricks on us. It makes it seem that the next lane is going faster than the lane we're in right now, even though all the lanes have the same average speed. And by the way, that illusion holds for every driver on the roadway.
Redelmeyer is a Canadian science researcher and co-author of a study of traffic weaving. And he wanted to know, do drivers make good decisions about changing lanes? The researchers had subjects look at computer simulations because it would be unethical to ask drivers to really change lanes on a real highway for an experiment. And they found out that most people believed that the next lane was going faster, even though it wasn't. But obviously, sometimes you've got to weave.
Of course. course you've got to change lanes. You'd be a bozo not to do it.
The problem is that drivers overestimate the benefits of changing lanes. And that puts you and everyone else on the highway at risk. Because when you change lanes, Rettelmeyer says, you're roughly three times as likely to get into an accident compared to staying in your lane. Back to the end of our Seattle traffic experiment, I'm meeting Mariah at her parking garage near Pioneer Square in downtown Seattle.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Where are you?
I just made it to the garage. How about you?
Oh, I am at 2nd and Columbia.
You're kidding! I was convinced I was so far behind.
Nope, I'm just coming to the stoplight now, so I'll be there in just a sec.
So after all the stress of moving between lanes, I got there under a minute faster. I put myself and other drivers at risk by changing lanes when I didn't have to, and there's the shame. Other drivers now know me as a weaver. In Seattle, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
Do you have questions about traffic or something else in the news? Just ask. Go to our website, KUOW.org. Thanks for tuning into The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. So you're walking down the street, probably not making eye contact with anyone if you're from Seattle. But even if you're not looking at anyone, law enforcement might be looking at you with the help of Amazon, depending where you are. The company's recognition software is in the news today as the ACLU objects to Amazon selling this technology to law enforcement. The New York Times' Nick Wingfield wrote a piece about the story. We're tweeting out the piece at KUOW, and we have Nick in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What exactly is Amazon doing with this program?
So what they have is a technology called Recognition with a K, and it's sold through their Amazon Web Services division. It's a generalized image recognition technology. You can use it for a lot of different things. One of the things that it did was it was used to recognize automatically celebrities in the video footage from the royal wedding over the weekend. But what we're talking about here is how they're selling it to law enforcement agencies for the purposes of facial recognition. So this is a technology that looks at the features of a face and can then be used to identify unknown criminal suspects through other imagery, whether that's footage, you know, video footage or still images.
Those sound like the kind of matches police already make. How is this substantially different?
Well, the scale of it is I think, different. I'll give you an example. Oregon, Washington County, Oregon, Sheriff's Department is one of the agencies that's using this technology from Amazon.
Not Washington State that we know of, by the way. I've heard Orlando. I've heard Oregon.
Yeah. Well, we don't know all of the customers. So okay. It's possible, but we don't know.
Okay.
Washington County Sheriff's Office in Oregon uploaded 300,000 mugshots from their jail. And that became the kind of online repository of identity and images. And then when a crime was committed, there was a robbery at a local home improvement store, for example, they took that image and matched it to a mugshot database online and were able to identify and then eventually apprehend the criminal. So that's actually a fairly specific case. I think most people probably wouldn't have a problem with it. What the ACLU is concerned about, however, is a kind of more generalized use of this technology, feeding video feeds into Amazon system and using it to kind of identify people in certain activities, maybe a political protest, maybe people who are suspected of being, you know, immigrants who are not here legally. And there are real concerns about civil liberties around this technology. It can be done on such a mass scale in such an automated fashion that that there's a lot of worry that it could be abused.
Is that worry more about the law enforcement side? Because, again, police have been known to track people, infiltrate groups. You're saying they could do this maybe on a bigger scale. Is it more that, or the fact that this is technology that's in a private company's hands? You mentioned Amazon's video feeds, or both. Help us understand what the concern is.
I don't think it's so much the latter about the private company, because the first thing I should say is Amazon did not invent this. They are actually kind of late to the game. They launched this technology in about 2016. But law enforcement has been using this technology for years. In fact, there's an estimate by the Georgetown Law Center that over 133 million American adults are searchable through facial recognition databases right now.
So, 130 million American adults are searchable through a facial recognition database.
About one out of every two adults in the United States.
I didn't know that.
And that is the data sets. These are obviously not all criminals. These are not people who have mugshots. They're accessing DMV databases and...
Even if I haven't signed up for example, the airport program, CLEAR, where you get a quicker security, just my having a driver's license, I could be one of those 130 million Americans.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So there are a lot of private security contractors that are offering this technology. I don't think there's so much a concern about the fact that the technology comes from a private company. The thing about Amazon is that it's a company that represents itself broadly as like a very customer-centric company. And, you know, it's also a brand name. I think most of these other companies that sell facial recognition technology are not known to the public. And this is a good opportunity for the ACLU to sort of bring attention to an existing subject using, you know, like a brand name company that's in the top, you know, two or three of, you know, most valuable American companies.
Yes. Okay. And you mentioned some of the concerns the ACLU has. Is there any evidence that any of these worst case scenarios have actually happened in law enforcement, American law enforcement?
Well, I think that there you hear stories about different ways, troubling ways in which it was used to identify protesters at rallies, but I don't think there's been enough transparency into how it's actually being used. I mean, often the technology is being used either by law enforcement or in commercial settings, stadiums and things like that, and it's not even actually revealed that it's being used. This can be done very discreetly. It's all happening in the cloud. There are cameras already in these venues, and so it's just something that's happening in the background. But there are some examples, I think, that are concerning. You know, I mean, one thing that I think is really troubling to the ACLU and others is that it's assumed that this technology is accurate, and there are actually studies that show it's really struggled with accuracy, particularly for different face types. So MIT, for example, did a study where they showed that the gender of darker-skinned women was misidentified more than for any other group. It was something like 35%. So that's a pretty big error rate when you're talking about a technology that's supposed to be, you know, this sort of magical, you know, identification system.
Okay. So there could be injustice. There could be false positives. Could there also be better exoneration if law enforcement were able to have more facial recognition?
You know, I think it's a really interesting idea that's worth exploring more. That's not something that the ACLU is focused on. Mm-hmm. I think different groups right now have different attitudes about this. The Georgetown Law Center, which studies this technology very closely, for example, recognizes that there are legitimate uses of the technology. You want to be able to use this to find, you know, a suspect in a crime. It's another, you know, item in the law enforcement toolbox that can be used legitimately. The ACLU is more on the end of this is a slippery slope. The potential for abuse as a mass surveillance tool is too high, and what they're really doing is asking Amazon to stop selling it. I don't think anybody really believes that all the other companies out there are going to stop selling it to law enforcement.
Right. That's important to know. This is New York Times technology correspondent Nick Wingfield is based in Seattle and wrote this story about ACLU's objection to Amazon making facial recognition technology available to local law enforcement. Are there countries, Nick, where the ACLU's worst fears are being more realized than they are here in the U.S.?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about how China is using this, for example, in lots of commercial ways and also sort of law enforcement ways. When you go into supermarkets there, you can use it as a form of kind of login to your payment system in some of the high-tech supermarkets that they have there. You know, there's also applications of it for catching jaywalkers in China. You know, somebody walks across the street, does something they aren't supposed to do. The police can use it to identify that person, send them a ticket, or even sort of publicly shame them.
Like our good to go or our red light cameras, but it's your license plate, it's your face.
Yeah, and I think the difference, though, with the with the car and also the cell phone, which can be used to track us as well, is that you can't leave your face at home. I mean, this is this thing that's attached to you. And I think that's one reason that civil liberties group feel that this is like a fundamentally sort of different technology than some of these other trackable things out there.
So do you know how Chinese people are reacting to that surveillance fact?
From what I've read, and I don't claim to be an expert on this, but from what I've read, the Chinese attitudes towards privacy are more tolerant of, you know, privacy, I guess what we would call overstepping on privacy here. People are willing to do this and just sort of feel that it's part of the just a more natural thing. And of course, you have more of an authoritarian government there, so they don't really have much of a choice.
So the U.S. could go that way, or we could go the opposite direction. Isn't Europe taking the, maybe not opposite, but Europe is much more restrictive of facial recognition technology?
Well, again, that's not an area where I've spent a lot of time reporting, but in general, the data protections in Europe are a lot greater. They have this coming data privacy law that's supposed to be enacted, I think, at the end of the week. But overall, I think America is somewhere in the middle. You know, it clearly is being used widely by law enforcement already. One out of two American adults in a facial recognition database. But, you know, whether or not Americans are okay with this, I think, is a different question. Most people just don't know that this stuff is actually being used.
Now you know more about, first of all, Amazon marketing its facial identification project product called Recognition to law enforcement agencies. And we've been talking about that this, of course, goes far beyond Amazon. It's just a nice target, a nice example for the ACLU to draw, which the ACLU is doing, raising red flags about the potential for mass surveillance. Again, it's Seattle-based New York Times technology correspondent Nick Wingfield following that story. Really appreciate you coming in, Nick. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning into The Record on KUOW. Is Seattle stuck in the 90s? That's coming up. It's The Record on KUOW. We're live tweeting the show now at KUOW. Is Seattle obsessed with its glory days? Pearl Jam's coming to Safeco Field soon. Ichiro's back with the Mariners. SeaTac Airport plays a message from Sir Mix-a-Lot. Is it fair to say that Seattle cannot get over the 90s? Seattle Met Magazine raised that question this week, and we have the perfect guests to answer it. In the early 90s, I was listening to Seattle DJ Marco Collins debuting Seattle bands on 107.7 The End. This is before every DJ in America was playing those bands. Welcome. Good to see you, Marco.
Thank you. Good to see you too, Bill.
And Karen Mason Blair is the Seattle photographer who photographed Pearl Jam's first concert.
I did.
Where was that?
It was at Off-Ramp.
At the Off-Ramp, classic. She shot to Alice in Chains' first photos for Rolling Stones, and her stuff's appeared on the albums of Nirvana, Soundgarden, Radiohead. Thanks for coming, Karen.
Thank you.
So let's start with some nostalgia. Karen, what was so great about the 90s in Seattle, for those of us who may not know?
Oh my gosh, it was like the time of your life. It was like, that was your local music. You would go out to see these bands, and then that would be Nirvana, you know, and you're like, that was it. And then you're standing next to Chris Cornell, and there's, you know, Kurt Cobain playing. And then the next week, Soundgarden's on stage, and then you're standing next to Kurt Cobain. And you're just like, these are our friends. And, you know, it was a small group of people, maybe like 200 to 300 people, was the grunge movement. And so we're all familiar.
It was super, super small. You remember, you were there too.
I wasn't there. I was just listening to you. I wasn't buddies with Kurt Cobain.
No, but you were doing stand-up. You were in the community.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I sound like a pretty big deal
you
when
are,
you put it like that.
Bill.
Why do you think Seattle got so famous for so many things in the 90s? Grunge, Sleepless in Seattle, Frasier, Starbucks, Baby Got Back. We were
hitting
fire. Big. We were on fire.
Yeah.
Why do you think that was?
I don't really know why it happened when it did, but it had been building up for a while. And I think that it might have had something to do with just a worldwide shift in music. And that Seattle was just ready to put out something that was pure, that was built on punk rock ethics. Mm-hmm. And it was just the right time.
Was that partly, you mentioned how small the community was, which I didn't know I was part of the Familia.
You are.
Was that part of it? Was that it was a small community at that time?
For me, yeah. When I first got to Seattle, it was 1991, and I was working. Obviously, I moved up here to start the radio station, The End. And I just remember within the first 2 weeks of being here, I was playing kickball in a muddy field with members of Mudhoney, Nirvana, the Young Fresh Fellows, and the Fastbacks. And I remember looking around, and maybe even a member of TAD. And I remember looking around going, this is the entire scene right here. This is so many of the people that are integral to this scene, and we're all just drinking beer and kicking a ball.
Was that part of it, Karen?
Yeah.
I guess contrast then to now, what creatively it was like in Seattle.
Yeah, well, I think exactly what Marco's saying. It's like we were just all together, and it's like I always say to my friends, if you're going to go to the top, you should take your friends, you know, like never go alone. And so in some way, we were just all building each other up, and there wasn't that competition. And even today, you know that
there wasn't.
No, there wasn't.
It was very different then for that reason.
Yeah, it was very supportive. It's like, you know, I would take the pictures, Jack and Dina would do production. You know, everybody was just all, you know, going through the same thing, doing the same thing with everybody. And
right.
So it was very collective, and it was just love. It was so much love and creativity. I just think for me, for the Seattle thing, is that there was a moment in time where this window of opportunity of creativity was wide open, you know, and then eventually it closed. Now it's kind of open again, you know, with the Amazon and stuff like that. And it's like we just have a lot of creativity in our city.
Well, let's talk about that. This, again, the Seattle Met Magazine reporter Darren Davis writes, for a progressive city on the cutting edge of the tech world, Seattle sure does rely on its old brands, particularly in areas the city struggles to match its former glory. So I mentioned we've been talking about the music. Ichiro technically, I think, came in 2001, but, you know, he's back. And
right.
I mentioned Sir Mix-a-Lot being relevant and at SeaTac Airport. And,
sure.
You know, Tom Douglas was a big deal then, and he's a big deal now. Do you think there's anything to this, the theory that Seattle is stuck in the 90s?
I don't. And I sure as heck tried to not remain stuck in the 90s. Karen and I have been friends for a long time. In fact, she introduced me to Kurt Cobain for the first time. You and Susie Tennant both introduced me to him for the first time.
How'd that go? Do you remember?
He wasn't in good shape. It was right when the record had really blown up and he wasn't in good shape. It was the Paramount show in 1991, and he didn't look well at all. That was the first time I met him. He got better.
Like not sober, not well?
Yeah, like not sober, and maybe he'd been on the road for a little too long, and, you know, he was kind of... He had sores on his neck and just he didn't look good at all.
Actually, that's going to bring up another question I'm going to ask you about whether the big Seattle culture boom made us happy. But
okay.
So we'll go there. but you were starting. I was asking you whether you say you don't think we're stuck in.
No,
that.
I don't. I mentioned that Karen and I, we actually just did a photo show exhibition memorabilia show. Between the two of us, and I demanded that we call it Nostalgia is for Losers, because I try very hard not to be stuck in that decade, even though everybody associates me with that decade.
Yeah.
I have no problem, but the reason that I was good at what I did back then is I wasn't looking at what was going on right then. I was looking at what was going to happen in a year, and I'm still doing that. I'm looking to the future, but I respect what happened. And I respect those bands, and I very much am grateful to have been a part of it. But I think there's so many fantastic bands going on in this city now. And I think if we're looking at pop culture icons, we've got a ton of them that aren't from the 90s that are still really important and maybe just aren't musical icons.
Okay, what comes to mind?
Well, I mean, Russell Wilson comes to mind first and foremost.
Right.
I mean, even the 12th man could be thought of as an icon.
Absolutely.
He crossed over from football star to pop culture star, partly because of marrying Sarah.
Yeah, absolutely. Joel McHale, I would say, is a pop culture icon. That's
true. He was locally famous in the 90s.
And I guess
then
so.
And then he went big nationally
right.
since then.
Yeah. Dan Savage also started kind of in the 90s, but he didn't really get his fame, you know, as a LGBTQ columnist until, what, the last 10 years?
And it gets better video.
Right, right. He was responsible for that.
Yeah. What do you think, Karen? Are you as skeptical as Marco is? Do you think Seattle is that fair to say, we're kind of stuck on the glory days?
Well, I think, if we're like... I don't have a problem with it. I mean, like, who wants to
quit? This is where we butt heads.
Yeah, it's
okay, go ahead.
It's like, who wants to quit the 90s? Like, why would you? Just, you know, silver and gold, make new friends and keep the old. I mean, it's like, we don't need to get over them, man. We fell in love with them, and they should just, you know, hang out with us for a little longer, just so you know, Marco.
Okay, I want to ask you about that. By the way, I mentioned Sir Mix-a-Lot. He's not just in the airport yeah. PA. He's on mornings on 103.7.
Absolutely.
We talked about, you said those were great times. But I, as you well know, I was there too. Many Seattleites were highly annoyed by the grunge explosion. It was good business for you two.
Sure.
But a lot of people in Seattle maybe say good riddance. It was a lot of exploitation and bands being overlooked and underlooked. Yeah. And
Seattle's never been a city to celebrate showboats. Like, they don't, that's not really what Seattle's ever been about. Like, you know, everything is sort of just kept a little bit more quiet here in Seattle. So, yeah, but I, at the same time, I think that because the town was so small, that it was really refreshing. I used to get calls from Kurt's mom on the air because she didn't really have a way to read how big her son was getting on the road other than what was happening on our radio station.
Uh-huh.
So she used to call me. I'd put her on the air. We'd talk about, you know, embarrassing things that Kurt did when he was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt's sister would be on the air with me all the time. The community really embraced those bands that were getting big. I think when it got crazy is when Fred Meyer started carrying Doc Martens, and you'd see these fashion, you know, Nordstrom would have displays in the window with combat boots.
In flannel
and whatnot, yeah.
We're asking whether Seattle stuck in the 90s with DJ Marco Collins and photographer Karen Mason Blair. And we have a great guest on the line here. We're talking about the Seattle Met story, decrying Seattle nostalgia. And one of their examples was that our most prominent restaurateur is still Tom Douglas. How do you feel about that, Tom Douglas?
Thank the Lordy. That's what I say. Thank the Lordy.
In case you don't know, Tom Douglas is a James Beard award-winning chef and owner of more than 6,000 Seattle restaurants. A lot of people don't know that.
Every one in downtown Seattle I own.
Yes, every single one. He owns them twice.
Pop culture icon, this guy right here. Oh.
Tom, here was the line, though, from this reporter at Seattle Met. You take a hot date to Eduardo Jordan's Solari or Rachel Yang's Revel. You take your parents to Dahlia Lounge.
Oh, come on.
What do you say to that?
Well, I don't know if the date's paying or not, but if the parents are paying, I say bring it on.
How do you?
It's funny. I've been going through this for a very long time. At 35 years old, I was called the grandfather of Northwest cuisine, and I got an offer from the junior league for a lifetime achievement award at 38 years old. Uh-huh. So you just never know how people perceive you.
Do you have personally any questions about whether you are resting on your culinary laurels?
Well, here's what I'll say. Obviously, you guys are too young to be able to remember or afford the Dahlia Lounge, but I will put it up against any restaurant in town, Solari or otherwise. And Eduardo's a friend of mine. It's not like that so much as, it's like I don't have the same chef that I had in 1989 when we opened. That was me. It is hopping right now. It's the busiest it's ever been. And I think that it's really just, you can never rest on your laurels. You have to keep reinventing. And that's something that we do at all of our joints.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not just sucking up to you when I say that if anybody hasn't been resting on your laurels, I mean, if anything, when I go to a restaurant that has tons of different cuisines, I'm wary of that place. But you, mm-hmm. Tom Douglas, pull off a different cuisine over and over and over.
Well, we try. We've been called just recently five years ago, best restaurant in America, best restaurateur in America. Wow. So, I mean, you just never know. I took it tongue-in-cheek, the whole article. I got to tell you, I am so sick of the Mariners resting on 1995, I could puke. So I get it from certain angles. I'd like to see them kick some butt today. But outside of that, they got nothing else to write about. And, he's probably a rookie writer. Just they were giving him something easy to kind of take on and go on from there.
Sounds like the Mariners could pick up Tom Douglas. And though he's not going to be a day-to-day, an everyday player, he could be good for the brand and maybe the occasional utility infielder.
Funny thing about the Mariners, speaking of dating myself, Jay Buhner, when he was playing with the M's, and of course Randy Johnson and Griffey and all those guys, Jay was sick to death of the food in the clubhouse meal. And he asked the Henry Gonzalez to have me cater the clubhouse meal. So every day from the Dahlia restaurant, I would cook dinner for 50 people, and I would take it down in the back of my truck and deliver it to the clubhouse, walk right through, and Griffey and, like I said, Randy Johnson, the big unit, and all those guys were there, and I would make the clubhouse meal.
Wow, there's a lot of energy in a coconut cream pie. That is Tom Douglas telling stories from the old days. Tom,
and here's the other thing I'll say. Yeah. You know, one of the things you get with an older restaurateur, an experienced restaurateur, that coconut cream pie, right, is just ridiculous how crazy it's become over the years. But we continue to donate about one a day to charity for auctions, and it has now raised over $2 million for charity.
Wow.
So ask some hot young restaurateur what they've done for society, and tell them to go blow some smoke.
All right. Talking some boomer trash. That's Tom Douglas. Great to talk to you again, Tom. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
And also with us, two icons of the 90s Seattle cultural scene, DJ Michael Collins, photographer Karen Mason Blair. So what about today? First of all, why do you think for a booming America's fastest growing city, et cetera, technology forward, why do you think we are not churning out so many national hot brands and icons these days? Or do you buy that?
I disagree.
Okay,
I don't buy that. I think we have Macklemore. I think that is,
woo-hoo,
he has become massive internationally. Again, I'd say,
turn my sound up, ricochet off our mountain. It's good medicine that she seldom would have been proud of. Says our city, town, pride, heart, blood, sweat, tears, I-5, north, south side, vibe, live, ride down these city blocks.
I think Marco Collins is going to cry.
Yeah, I'm not going to cry.
About your city.
You know what I like about him, though? He does pay respects to this city.
He's all the time.
He knows where he lives, and he's proud of it. I mentioned Dan Savage, Reggie Watts.
Yeah,
another pop culture icon from MockTube, and now he's, you know, on the Late Late Show. What's it called, with James Corbin?
Yeah,
he's doing Glenn Beck.
What?
Now see,
he's from here.
Yeah, he's from here as well.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you know, for a minute I looked up the word icon because I wasn't sure if it had to be just somebody that you idolized or if it could just be a representation of that time period. I mean, we have Mary Kay Letourneau.
An icon.
Yes.
What do you think, Karen? Seattle, what about today?
I love him.
Is the, who doesn't?
Yeah, right.
You could say the affordability problem, you know, scattering people out of Seattle, the gentrification. I don't know, whatever, the things that you see going on today and you're still, you know, photographing and documenting. Do you see, what's the state of Seattle for creating excitement and culture right now?
Well, I think it's happening. I think, like you're saying, it's just happening in kind of like not in a musical way. And I think that's where my heart, you know, my heart's kind of sad. But I mean, Macklemore, hands down, one of my favorite. And the city loves him and and he loves us. And, you know, like Marco was saying, we got, you know, Russell Wilson and Chris Pratt. And I mean, that trifecta right there makes you happy. I mean, do we need much more besides those three anyways? But it's curious to me, but I think like Seattle's still generating a lot of stuff. And then the platform to create music got so much smaller, so more people can jump on it, which actually dilutes it. And therefore, to have another movement is really hard because you get one song over here and one song over there instead of all the songs coming out of one place or all the music coming out of one place at one time, you know. So that's another reason why it's kind of stalled, actually.
Here's one more updated musical reference that Marco brought us. This is Sam LaChow.
Yes.
Right? And the track is Ambivalent.
I got some throwaway bars, you probably never hear those. I'm talking like De Niro, I got a throwaway phone. I'm not perfect, I once freed 7 monkeys from the circus. And I turned my phone off on purpose. I put my thing down, flip it, and reverse it. Like, if they're made it, bitch, from writing it.
Nice. A Missy Elliott reference.
Yeah, the Missy Elliott.
From our local. So you're big on the Seattle hip-hop scene, though it hasn't gone grunge crazy.
Yeah, I think everybody thought it was going to take off with the Blue Scholars and, you know, Macklemore taking off. And I think that it's healthy. I think that it's, you know, definitely solid. Now we have some women in the scene that I think are amazing. Gifted Gab is starting to blow up on a national level, and
She's fierce.
We'll play a little of that as we go out. We got to go. I had so much fun talking about this. Mm-hmm. Seattle DJ Marco Collins, photographer Karen Mason Blair. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you about Seattle, loving the 90s and living for today. Here's a little Gifted Gab and Blimesbricks.
Some might call me hazardous. Not too many that can handle this. I'm a hip-hop analyst. Let me channel my inner animal. I'm a cannibal like Hannibal. When I spit it, baby, it's flammable. Look, I'm going for your clavicle. About my capital was murder tactic. The actual.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. The record. There we go.
Black hands
mean the black sky looks dead. The record on KOW. Still loving the 90s. It's produced by Amin Al-Sadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jim Abrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Talk to you tomorrow.
Black hole sun, won't you come?